which is the first of two talks on equanimity. I'd like to begin this evening with all of us spending a few moments this evening sitting under the Bodhi tree with the about-to-be Buddha, or as though sitting under the Bodhi tree with the about-to-be Buddha. Yourself comfortably, and you might like to close your eyes. The end of that long and now famous night under the bow tree. And after Mara, the personification of all the dark and potentially destructive forces in the mind, had let fly the poison arrows of greed, of aversion, and delusion at Siddhartha Gautama. The arrows that Mara hoped would stick and then distract Siddhartha from his clarity and the strength of his great vow and his courageous determination to fully awaken. Mara shot the last arrow that was left in his quiver, the quiver being the arrow holder. And this was the arrow of doubt, the arrow of self-doubt. He shot this arrow at the Buddha, accompanied by the words, "What makes you think you have the right to be sitting here? What makes you think you have the right to be sitting here, where, and how you are? Just who do you think you are, anyway?" Bodhisattva, the just about to be Buddha, protected within the great strength of his mindful presence, which was enlivened by a keen interest and a penetrating sense of investigation, accompanied by clear discernment. This about to be Buddha, supported by the tremendous energy of his determination and the flow of an effortless effort, imbued with an enlivening and refreshing joy, balanced within the deep power and cool ease of an unwavering and undistracted mind. Siddhartha Gautama, sitting under the bow tree that night, with unshakable stability, with an evenness and balance of receptive presence, as though he were an immovable mountain. With all of these qualities, these factors of mind and heart perfectly in place, in response to Mara's challenge, the Bodhisattva, with his amazing grace, simply reached down and touched the earth with the fingertips of his right hand, letting Mara know that the earth was bearing witness to his right to be sitting where and how he was. And Mara was defeated at that moment, never again to have any power over the Buddha. So we sit, maybe not always quite like the Buddha, but we sit and we practice. We sit and we walk, practicing here in retreat. And all of us have practiced and will practice most likely intensively again in other places, at other times, alone and together, alone and with others. In Taos, New Mexico, where I live, we have what is considered a sacred mountain. It's one amongst many of the mountains that surround the Taos Valley. This sacred mountain is actually within the Pueblo, the village of the Tiwa Indians in Taos. And this particular mountain is sacred to the Tiwa people. And it's also in some way sacred to many people who live in Taos, who are not Indians. And I happen to have the very good fortune to be able to look out at it and take it in every season, any time of the day or night, on any day of the year, as it's very clearly visible from where I live. This mountain, or any mountain, just simply sits where it is. The sun shines on it. Rain and hail fall on it. Snow might cover it. Lightning strikes it. Fires sometimes may rage on it. And all sorts of life forms are born and die on it, living out their particular life patterns on and with the mountain. And the mountain remains unshakable, unwavering, the mountain of radical acceptance, the mountain of equanimity. The mountain itself is a live energy, a lively energy. But it only exists in relationship to all of the other myriad, many lively energies, constantly changing lively energies that constitute it, that make it up. The mountain appropriately sustains and supports the activity that is intricately and intimately connected to it, that it's connected with. The mountain of equanimity doesn't cling on, it isn't attached or averse to anything. We might say it lets life live through it. Lets life live through itself, closing off to nothing, holding on to nothing. And all of this happens with the amazing grace of impartiality and balance. We'll begin to explore equanimity. Upekkha is the Pali word. A powerful force in our practice, a powerful force in the whole of our life. In the Buddhist teaching, it's included as one of the 10 paramis, or 10 perfections. It's, of course, one of the 4 divine abidings, one of the 4 Brahma-viharas. It's also the predominant experience of the 4th jhana, 4th state of concentration, jhana concentration. And it's also one of the 7 enlightenment factors. So it's quite important in these teachings and practices. And in fact, upekkha was the final factor to come into maturity as the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree that now famous night, with an evenness and balance in his very relaxed and powerful presence, as though he were an immovable mountain. As he sat there in his amazing grace, seeing things clearly, and relinquishing, or letting go in his heart, in his mind, relinquishing all of the attachments, relinquishing all attachments to formations of body and mind. And finally breaking through to the great liberation, the great awakening, breaking through to the complete ending of suffering. He is the fearlessness, the power, and the equilibrium, or the balance, of the heart, of the mind, in experience, in relationship to experiencing all kinds of change. The fearlessness, the power, and the balance of heart, the balance of mind, to experience every sort of manifestation and change in the realms of internal experience and external experience, and in the realm of feeling in the Buddhist teachings are the feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, or unpleasant, that are associated with the arising, the change, and the passing of internal and external phenomena. The Buddha described what he called six-limbed equanimity. The equanimity of one whose afflictive states, or cankers, as he sometimes called them, I mentioned this term the other evening, whose afflictive states or cankers have been destroyed, either destroyed temporarily or completely, finally destroyed, and who abides in the natural state of purity in relationship to desirable or undesirable objects that come into focus at any of the six sense doors. And this is a quote from the Buddha. Here is a bhikkhu, or here a bhikkhu or a yogi, person in retreat, whose cankers are destroyed, is neither overjoyed nor distraught on seeing a visible object with the eye, hearing an audible sound with the ear, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. She or he dwells in equanimity, mindful, and fully aware. Equanimity is the fearlessness and great strength and the ease of the heart and the mind to remain centered and unmoved in the midst of it all. The literal translation of the Pali word equanimity is onlooking. So equanimity looks on. It looks on at the occurrences of physical and mental pleasure and pain by maintaining a neutral stance, by staying in the middle, staying in the center, and watching things as they arise and pass. On looking, it sees them fairly. It sees them without favoritism. It sees them without bias, without any partiality. So one attribute of equanimity itself is, as it's described in the realm of feeling, is neither a painful nor pleasant feeling, but a neutral feeling. We could say that equanimity is the equipoise, and I don't know what that word might be in. Or does anybody know? Equipoise. What is it? Okay. Yeah, it has a certain other taste to it, but that's good enough. We could say that equanimity is the equipoise, the balance, or the equilibrium between the two opposing forces in the mind of the desired and the undesired. So this equanimity of, or this equipoise of equanimity offsets the weightiness of greed, the weightiness of aversion. It's that point of balance in the middle of the seesaw of life. The heart, the mind, doesn't move towards, nor does it move away. I remember as a child, I used to love to find the point of balance when I was playing on what we called the seesaw or the teeter-totter with another child, where one sits on one side and one sits on the other. And I just loved to find that point of balance when we were playing that, because there was always a certain kind of happy and almost breathtaking feeling inside when that moment happened. A poem by T.S. Eliot, who says this, talks about this quite beautifully. At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance is. But neither arrest nor movement, and do not call it fixity, where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline, except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance. And there is only the dance of equanimity is a place of protection. And at the same time, it's a great spaciousness and a strength of mind, a strength of heart. The Buddha used the metaphor of putting a spoonful of salt into a cup of water. And because of this small container, the water will be extremely salty. It will be harsh. It will be undrinkable. On the other hand, if we put a spoonful of salt into a large body of water, the size of the Mediterranean Sea, for instance, it won't have the same effect because of the enormous amount of water, because of the great spaciousness that the salt was put into. Life is quite salty at times. I'm sure you would all agree. It's just how it is. One aspect of the development of equanimity is about creating the spaciousness of heart, the spaciousness of mind, in which we can meet and look on at all of life's experiences, all of the internal, all of the external phenomena, with balance, with equipoise, with what's sometimes called the heart of greatness, with what is called in the suttas, the Buddha suttas, in relationship to equanimity as a factor of enlightenment, to look on with what the Buddha called a specific neutrality. So, what does this mean? A specific neutrality. It means that whatever states of consciousness are present, including at times the other three Brahmaviharas, metta, karuna, mudita, the other six enlightenment factors, which are mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, and concentration, as well as the arising of other various states of consciousness, such as patience, faith, that all of them all of them are met and seen and looked on at evenly through the heart, the mind of equanimity. The function of equanimity is to inhibit partiality. So upekkha manifests as neutrality. There's a wonderful little book of teachings by Zen Master Dogen. It's called How to Cook Your Life, where Dogen uses the work of the monastery cook, the Tenzo, and our relationship to food to teach us. And in this case, to teach us about equanimity. And of course, we can bring this teaching immediately close, right now, right here, in relationship to our Tenzos here, our cooks, our amazing cooks, and into our own life when we go back home and maybe cook our own food. And these are Dogen's words. He says, handle even a single leaf of lettuce, or single leaf of green, not lettuce necessarily, handle even a single leaf of a green in such a way that it manifests the body of the Buddha. This in turn allows the Buddha to manifest through the leaf. This is a power you cannot grasp with your rational mind. It operates freely, according to the situation, in a most natural way. At the same time, this power functions in our lives to clarify and to settle activities, and is beneficial to all living beings. And he goes on to say, a dish is not necessarily superior because you've prepared it with choice ingredients, nor is a soup inferior because you've made it with ordinary greens. When handling and selecting greens, do so wholeheartedly, with a pure mind, and without trying to evaluate their quality, in the same way in which you would prepare a splendid feast. And he continues, in practicing the Dharma, or the Dhamma, delicious and ordinary tastes are the same and not two. There's an old saying, the mouth of a monk or the mouth of a yogi is like an oven. Just as an oven, and this is not exactly what happens here in Israel, but it used to, and probably still does actually, as a matter of fact, in some communities here. Just as an oven burns both sandalwood and incense for incense and cow dung for cooking, without distinction, our mouths should be the same. There should be no distinction between delicious food and food which is plain and simple. We should be satisfied with whatever we receive. Dogen's advice to us about equanimity. So how does one look on at the mind with equanimity? What contributes to looking on at the mind in this way? What contributes to this capacity of relating to all things with equanimity? When we practice here in retreat and in our life outside of retreat, when at times the heart, the mind is tranquil, serene, calm, and this is known, when we recognize that the focusing power of the mind, the concentration, is evenly and repeatedly connecting with whatever the object of attention is, such as the metta phrases, or the particular object of your metta practice. when the mind isn't listless or lazy, and when it isn't agitated, but is interested and energized, appropriately energized. At those times, we don't feel the necessity. We don't feel empowered. We aren't interested in exerting or restraining or encouraging the mind in any way. Everything is just fine as it is. Simply recognizing and knowing that this is what's occurring, that these factors of mind are in place for maybe a brief time or maybe for a longer time, is actually something that contributes to the blossoming of our capacity to relate to all things with equanimity. So how we relate to what's coming up in our practice, of course, contributes to being able to relate to all things with equanimity, what comes up in our mind in practice. In the time and in the culture of the Buddha, he used a metaphor for the mind when it's in this mode. And this is his metaphor. He said, one is like a charioteer, a person who drives a chariot. Who looks on with equanimity on horses progressing evenly. Now that didn't feel so, I didn't relate to that so well, you know, in my life. So I changed it. I think a metaphor that's more of our experience might be, one is like the driver of a car who looks on with equanimity in a car that's running along on cruise control. And we're able to see what's in front of us and what's passing by with ease. This quality, this factor of mind, equanimity, allows the process of practice, the blossoming of insight, the progress of insight to unfold without getting caught, without getting mired in the habits of mind that stop things up, the various habits of clinging, attachment and identification that can create a block, that can create a tangle in the flow of the process. Within the environment or the ambiance of equanimity, even the subtlety of the habits of identification, which can be very subtle, and the comparing mind, which can also be somewhat subtle, can be seen and be known and not be clung to, allowing then understanding, insight to blossom, to deepen, and to move towards maturity. And as we all know, I'm sure, until equanimity is really truly matured, we lose and we regain our balance over and over and over again. Quite a number of years ago now, for the last 2 weeks of a long retreat that I was sitting, I practiced equanimity for those two full weeks. And in the way that it's practiced as a Brahma-vihara, as a divine abiding, which was silently repeating one phrase, one equanimity phrase, over and over and over again, and directing it towards myself, and then on through all of the same categories that you've been using for metta practice. And the one equanimity phrase is this: I am the owner, or I am the heir. Heir meaning
yours.
Of my karma. My karma, my deeds of thought, mind, speech, and action. I am the heir or the owner of my karma. My karma. My happiness or suffering depends upon my actions, not upon my wishes for myself. So that's what I repeated for 2 weeks, directing it towards myself and towards the whole list of categories that you've been practicing with over these days. When I repeat it to others, it's you are the owner, you are the heir of your own karma. Your happiness and suffering depends upon your actions, not upon my wishes for you. By the end of those 2 weeks, there was quite a deep and quiet sense of balance, a sense of evenness, of neutrality, in the heart and in my mind. A day or two before the end of the retreat, the thought came up to me, well, there's equanimity here. Seems to be a fairly deep and abiding equanimity. And then the next thought was, I wonder if there's an equanimity test. And the thinking went on, and I thought, well, if this was a Zen session, any good Zen teacher would do something creatively startling to test my equanimity. But this is a Vipassana retreat, and Vipassana teachers don't do things like that. So then the thoughts just, they disappeared. But later that day, I was startled in, we could say, true Vipassana fashion, an equanimity test, Vipassana style. I got a note that was signed by one of my equanimity teachers. But actually it was a note that was from all five of the teachers that were teaching this retreat. And it said, we would like you to give the Dhana talk to the yogis tomorrow. So for a moment, equanimity flew right out the window. It felt like my heart stopped, actually. And the old habit of fear flew inside. And the thoughts came, I can't do this. My old habit said, I just can't. I've been silent for weeks and weeks and weeks, months, and deeply into practice. I can't get up in front of all my fellow yogis and talk. I can't do it. Impossible. And then the heart, the mind relaxed and saw what had just occurred. And then the thought came in, ah, this is my equanimity test. Okay. And I can do it, and I want to do it. And then at that moment, a tremendous flood of gratitude came into the heart. Gratitude for the teachers, gratitude for the staff, the retreat staff, for the teachings, gratitude for the practice. And just as suddenly as it had gone, equanimity was back. And what I was being asked to do felt like the most natural thing in the world to be doing. So we lose and we regain our balance again and again and again, as practice unfolds and deepens. Upekkha manifests as quieting fear, quieting dislike, resentment, self-judgment. They can manifest sometimes as guilt or disapproval of not being good enough, not being enough. It also manifests as quieting liking, quieting pride, quieting attachment, quieting the judgment of approval in relationship to what we think of as ourself, as me, as my experiences. And of course, equanimity also manifests as quieting the attachment and the fear that comes up in relationship to others. When equanimity has arisen and is developing, in those moments, fear and resentment, attachment, identification, and the judgments of approval or disapproval, they subside. Within this clear space of a really true neutrality, there's nothing for greed, there's nothing for aversion to stick to when they arise. And they may arise, but they don't stick to anything, so they go very quickly. Equanimity fails when it produces what the Buddha called the equanimity of unknowing. And he also called it worldly-minded indifference produced by ignorance. Worldly-minded indifference produced by ignorance. So let's look at this. What does this mean? Worldly-minded indifference produced by ignorance. When we don't clearly see or don't clearly see through the object of our attention, with a focused attention, a concentrated attention, with mindfulness and with investigation and the open-heartedness of acceptance. And instead, we're blindly seduced and swept away in the happenings of life, seemingly as though equanimous with it all. This is not upekkha. It's what the Buddha called indifference based in ignorance. Ignorance ignoring what is really happening, how things really are. And this is a quote from the Buddha again. I'm seeing a visible object with the eye. And he goes on in relationship to each of the six sense doors. But we'll just talk about seeing at this point. On seeing a visible object with the eye, equanimity arises in the foolish, infatuated, ordinary man or woman, in the untaught ordinary man or woman who hasn't seen or conquered his or her limitations. Misquote here. Okay. No, it's not. On seeing a visible object with the eye, equanimity arises in the foolish, infatuated, ordinary man or woman, in the untaught ordinary man or woman who hasn't seen and hasn't conquered his or her limitations, who hasn't understood or conquered future results, meaning what happens with karma. Who is unperceiving of danger in relationship to attachment, in relationship to aversion. This equanimity, this kind of equanimity, doesn't see through the visible object. Such so-called equanimity is actually indifference based in ignorance. So it's not really equanimity, it's indifference. Based in stupidity, ignorance, not seeing. And the Buddha, for those of you that haven't read any of the suttas, he was often very, very direct, very straightforward in his teachings, as this one is. So another brief personal story. When I first began living in Taos in New Mexico, it's a place where there are many artists, many craftspeople, and many, many beautiful things that are made by the people that live there. And many people come to Taos because of the art and the crafts to see and buy and that kind of thing. So the store windows, many of the stores in the one little downtown area, it's a very small town, are filled with these beautiful things. When I first moved there, I would see them in the windows. And at times I would get quite infatuated with them. And I would feel, I want, I want, I want, I want. And sometimes I would even think, I need, I must have. So fortunately, I didn't have the money to do it, but I had the feeling. Notice how painful. I mean, it was very painful. This contraction of the must-have mind. So I decided to make a practice of it. So I would take myself along the street, walking along the street, and look in the windows and watch my mind. And I did it over and over again, you know, over a period of months, and watch my mind and just watch it, very mindful, with interest. And all the time, all of that wanting and needing dissolved. And I could walk along and look in the windows and appreciate the beauty, appreciate the work that went into the crafts, and not feel like I needed it, wanted it, had to have it. And it was a huge relief, and it was a very practical practice in the midst of my life. The Dalai Lama tells a story about himself in a big city. I think it was London, I'm not sure, but he was taken to a particular part of the city where there are many shops that sell all kinds of very tiny mechanical parts. As some of you may know, he has quite an interest and quite a fascination with mechanical things, small things. He likes to take watches apart, for instance, and then put them back together again. So somebody out of kindness, you know, took him to this part of the city where there was a shops, many shops, with all these tiny little mechanical parts. And he says that he was walking along and he had this strong inner feeling, he noticed, of wanting all of them. And he said, and then he realized that he didn't even know what any of them were for. So next time you go shopping or window shopping, make it a practice. And I think probably all of us know that when we're inflamed with greed or fear or resentment, it isn't possible at those times to look on at those moments with a true equanimity. And we probably all also know the pretense, the pretending of equanimity within ourselves, in the midst of greed, in the midst of resentment, in the midst of anger or fear or disappointment. There's this glossing over the ignorance, actually, ignoring these states and pretending to ourselves. The pretense of equanimity. This feeling of, well, it doesn't really matter. When it does really matter. But pretending I'm equanimous, I don't really care. I'm okay. It's okay. It doesn't really matter. And often those pretending of equanimity, those pretenses of equanimity, may be accompanied by a slight or maybe not so slight moving away or contraction if we really look carefully. And this is indifference, the near enemy of equanimity, what masquerades as equanimity. It is based on an attentive, clear presence, not on dullness, not on indifference. And it's not a kind of passing, casual mood. And it's also not produced by a strong exertion. It's the result. It's one of the fruits of practice. The fruit of training the mind, training the heart, and the development and the blossoming of the factors of mindfulness, investigation, a balanced effort in our practice, joy, tranquility, concentration, loving kindness, compassion. True equanimity is able to meet all of the vicissitudes of life. Vicissitudes, we've already talked a little bit about them. The flip-flops of the mind that we encounter maybe daily here in retreat, in our own mind, and that we encounter in our own mind and coming from others in our life outside of retreat. The eight worldly winds, as they're sometimes called, the vicissitudes, praise, blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and distinction or disrepute, disrespect, a good reputation, a bad reputation. True equanimity is actually able to meet all of these sometimes harsh tests, we could say. Able to regenerate, equanimity is able to regenerate its strength from sources within ourselves, within us, from the growing development of the factors of enlightenment that I've mentioned, along with the development of various other qualities, various other capacities that blossom through our practice, the other three divine abidings, other states such as confidence, faith, and of course, as I said, loving kindness, compassion, joy. Amazing practice that used to be and maybe still is done sometimes by the Hopi Indians, and I definitely don't recommend this practice, but we can take it as a metaphor for us in relationship to the cultivation and the manifestation of the power of fearlessness, evenness of mind, evenness of heart, and the great protection of and strength of equanimity. And this is from a book by a man named Frank Waters from the Book of the Hopi. The snakes, rattlesnakes, big bull snakes, blue racers, sidewinders, gopher snakes, all 60, all tangled on the floor. The singing stirred them. They moved in one direction and then in another, looking over all the men in the circle. The men never moved. They just kept singing with a kind expression on their faces. The snakes began to roll in the sand, taking their bath. Then a big yellow rattlesnake moved slowly towards an old man, singing with his eyes closed, and climbed up his crossed leg, coiled in front of his breechcloth, and went to sleep. Pretty soon, this old man had five or six snakes crawling over his body, raising their head to look at his closed eyes and peaceful face, and then going to sleep. It showed they had found their friend, looking within the heart of one upon whose body they chose to rest. This is the way snakes show who are good and kind men with pure hearts. Not one that I would like to do, but we will possess the power of protection and the power of a wholesome resistance in relationship to the mind, the heart, getting seduced by and caught up in states of fear, greed, aversion, and will possess the power of renewing itself only if it's deeply rooted in insight. There are two particular insights that as they develop and as they ripen are really the root of equanimity. And this evening I'd like to speak about one of them, and then tomorrow we'll look at another, the other, the second one. These is our growing clarity in understanding how the vicissitudes of life originate, how they come to be. The understanding that the various experiences of stress, the various experiences of suffering, and the experience of ease are the result of our karma, the result of our actions of thought, speech, and deed, right here and now, in this lifetime, and then on back and back and back. This is our karma. This is karma. Karma. I use the word karma because it's more common. We could say that we're born. We could say that we spring out of the womb of karma. And even though we might not like it at times, we're the heirs, we're the owners of our karma. So for instance, an example, just as soon as we've spoken some words or we've performed some action, we've totally lost control of it. And yet, it remains with us. And in some way, inevitably returns to us as our due inheritance. We could say that everything that happens and the ease or the dis-ease in our heart, in our mind, is the outcome of our mind's relationship to all of the happenings internally and externally. Our suffering and our happiness in this life in any given moment is due to our own mind, our motivations, and our actions of speech and body. Not due to our wishes, our hopes for ourselves, and certainly not due to some other person or some outer, some antagonistic, seemingly strange or foreign world. Understanding begins to take root in us. It actually has the power to free us from fear. And so it's the first basis of equanimity. When, in fact, with everything that happens around us and within us, we begin to see that we only meet ourselves, what is there to fear? The heart begins to relax. And I'm going to repeat this because it's very important. When, in fact, with everything that happens around us and within us, we begin to see that we only meet ourselves, what is there to fear? The heart begins to relax. We begin to know that we can change our mind, that we're not trapped on the karmic wheel running around and around and around. Of course, as all of us have experienced, fear, uncertainty, insecurity arise along the way. And at the same time, as we go this path, as we traverse this path, we certainly begin to see and we begin to know that the refuge from fear, that the refuge where fear can be dispelled, is through our actions, through our good deeds, our good actions. So refuge from this perspective is in wholesome thought. It's in wholesome motivations. It's in wholesome words and performing wholesome actions. And as we take this refuge, we come to have a growing confidence in the great protecting power of good deeds that we've done in the past, and a growing courage to just keep performing more wholesome deeds right now, even in the midst of what might be some hardships in our life. And our practice itself, this incredible training of the heart that we're all engaged in here, is a very good deed. The best, really, the best deed. And really the essential ground for the blossoming of wholesomeness in through all aspects of our life. Things that's been very important to me in understanding karma is that it's always the right time to perform wholesome actions. It's always the right time to do good deeds. It's never too late. Sometimes I thought, it's too late. It's never too late. Practice this, and it becomes established in us. It becomes a refuge. And at some point, we really know for sure, as was said by one of the Buddhist disciples, he said, more and more ceases the misery and the evil rooted in the past. And in this present life, I try to make it spotless and pure. What else then can the future bring other than the increase of the good? More and more a certainty in our heart, the mind becomes more tranquil, more serene. And we gain the great strength of a patient heart and the evenness and the balance of equanimity in relationship to the various challenges and the various difficulties in our life. As the refuge of doing good deeds becomes our way, our deeds become our friend rather than an adversary. Does everybody know what adversary is?
No.
What is it? You don't know?
Yeah.
They don't know, so... Okay, good.
Yeah. Like an enemy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Against. Somebody against. So our deeds become our friend rather than against us, our adversary. Even if sometimes the results of our deeds might bring us sorrow or might bring us discomfort or might bring us pain, maybe in relationship to the way others treat us or through some upheaval or some turmoil in our life, or maybe in some surprising or some unrecognizable way. And even if sometimes the results that occur aren't what we expected, not what we had in mind, results that maybe are contrary or seem contrary to what we might think our motivation is. Many years ago, I had a therapist who would sometimes say to me, or more accurately, say for me, at appropriate times in my work with her, she would say, this isn't what I had in mind. And she said it for me, not for her. So something, I would be expressing something, and she would say, this isn't what I had in mind. Which would always just stop me right in my tracks, and move me to take a look, to take a very close look at my expectations, at my motivations. And even more importantly, in those moments, to really just simply be with what was occurring with an open heart and as clear a mind as was possible at that time. If we are teacher, then in a sense we could say it becomes our friend. And maybe it's sometimes a stern friend, and maybe quite a demanding teacher. and yet potentially a truthful and very well-intended friend. We learn about ourselves, which seems to be our most difficult subject. The way of our practice, with the development and the blossoming of relative equanimity, we find that we have the strength to endure when we need to endure something or situation. And we have the strength to clearly see when that's called for. In befriending suffering, by looking at it very directly, very clearly, we have the possibility of not continuing to blindly fall into the same holes over and over and over again, but to begin to walk down a different street. The teachings of karma and the understanding within this can imbue us, enlighten us with a very powerful motivation to free ourselves from karma, to free ourselves from the actions that again and again and again throw us into repeated suffering, to free ourselves from repeatedly being born or repeatedly being reborn into the realm of suffering. So as we more and more clearly see our own craving, our own delusion, and our habitual tendencies to create and engage in situations that, for instance, sap our strength, sap our healthy resistance. The Buddha talked about, at that point, a disgust arises. He called it a disgust. And our motivation to practice in order to free ourselves from craving, to free ourselves from delusion, is strengthened. This is the first insight, the first insight that's the basis of equanimity, this insight, this understanding of karma. Stop here, and we'll continue exploring equanimity tomorrow evening. So let's sit for just a few moments.